Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Why doesn't it curl? 6-year-old Belinda lamented, twirling her straight black locks around her fingers and looking longingly into the next room at her older sister Aisha's full head of long, tight curls. Well, dear, her mom began, you inherited my kind of hair, and Aisha inherited hair like your dad and your Aunt Benita. Then how come I look like Dad the rest of the way and not like you? My skin's the same color as his and Aisha's, not like yours. What happened to my hair? Oh, sweetie, your hair is pretty. It's shiny and you can pull it back into a ponytail with a ribbon when it's hot outside. And you know, her mother whispered conspiratorially, Aisha's hair won't work with braids, but yours will. She smiled. But, Belinda continued to twirl her hair around her fingers, Denisha's hair is curly. Louise's hair is curly. Ariella's hair is curly. How come I'm the only one who doesn't have curls? From a parent's perspective, what should we know about raising multiracial children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today we're fortunate to have a guest who has dealt with Belinda's problem as both a parent and a researcher. Donna Jackson Nakazawa is the author of Does Anybody Else Look Like Me? A Parent's Guide to Raising Multiracial Children. Ms. Nakazawa has been a regular contributor to the AARP magazine, My Generation, as well as to Modern Maturity and Working Mother, Baby Talk, and New Woman. She has two children. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you feel the need to write this book?
Well, I think that as I began my family with my husband, who's Japanese-American, and I come from a European background, I certainly hope to raise my children colorblind, not thinking about color any more than I did in my heart when I married my husband. But as I ventured out with these small babies, first my son, who's now almost 9, I realized that there was a double-take response in the world around me to see this blonde-haired, blue-eyed mom going around with a front pack with an Asian baby, Asian appearing. And so I started to notice the longer lingering stares in the supermarket. People started to come up to me and say everything from, he doesn't look anything like you, or where did you get him, or how did you get a baby boy from China? And in the beginning, it was something I could navigate because I felt my son was too young to understand this inquisitive question that the world was asking. But as he became older, I saw that it was having an effect on him. He was becoming uncomfortable with these long, lingering looks. He was becoming uncomfortable with the many questions that were being asked of me in front of him. What is he? Do you ever get used to the fact he doesn't look anything like you? Do you realize you're one of the only moms in town who has an Asian baby? Things like that from people left, right, and center, certainly not ill-intended, but nevertheless, the combination of these looks and questions began to make him feel uncomfortable, and I could read that, and it made that Richter scale of my maternal instincts go a little crazy.
We know you thoroughly researched this book. What did you learn that can help your children when issues arise, like you mentioned, about race or family?
Well, I should say that when this occurred more and more, and when my son began to have his own little experiences on the playground, I figured there had to be a book out there. Mm-hmm. I'm a journalist, so I ran right over to the bookstore, and there wasn't anything. And so that's why I set out to interview these 60 families and the top experts in the country. And I spent 2 years really delving into it with them, people of every mixed-race background from every corner of America, because I wanted to find out the answer to that question. And I wanted to have it in my own hands and share it with other parents.
How did you find the 60 people?
Well, I sort of put out an APB through the different channels that I have as a journalist and as a parent, and I had hundreds of offers pretty much right away.
All ages.
So all ages, all backgrounds, and again, I was conscious of getting people from the California experience and the New York experience and the Tulsa, Oklahoma experience, because they're all very different, but they do share common threads.
Well, does color matter? What do we tell our kids?
Well, again, as I went to raise my children, I thought that I could raise them colorblind, and many, many other parents with whom I spoke originally hoped for the same thing. And then they realized that while it's fine to say color doesn't matter in your own home, sometimes when you leave those four walls, color does matter. I know there's a famous phrase, race is as real as its consequences. So that if an African-American dad and a white mom are walking down the street with their baby in the stroller and somebody walks by and says, ew, disgusting, which happened to one of my families,
Oh my gosh. It
may be that they're colorblind in their hearts, and it may be that in their home color's a non-issue, but once you leave that home, it does become an issue. And what I found was that there are two groups of multiracial children. The first group has been really well prepared by their parents, beautifully prepared through different means that I'll go into in depth in a moment. And so that as they grow up and somebody says, are you black or are you white? What are you? Or why do you have little black holes for eyes? They are able to just articulate, well, my mom is this, my dad is that, so what? And it's water off the duck's back. Then there's another multiracial child for whom this is very traumatic. And it impacts them in very negative ways. As we look at the research as children get older, children who have been really sufficiently prepared to be multiracial in a monoracial world tend to have some added pluses as people. They're able to cross borders between races. They're able to be bridges between groups of people. They have a certain flexibility and adaptability and creative thinking skills often that come from having been immersed in more than one culture. And we see those advantages for them as they go out into the world. Another group is more at risk, and they do have more health risk behaviors. It's a very small group, but it does exist. And they are more at risk than their monoracial peers. Again, it's a small number, but I want to really articulate that I want parents to be able to look at what's in this book and shared from these families and these experts and have all their children in category one.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many ways that I found that families were going about doing this.
How do they? How do you communicate to your child all the different parts of his being?
Well, the first way is that from a very young age, what works really well for multiracial children, and I'll kind of take you through developmentally as quickly as I can, but that the first thing is to just fill your home with lots of things that represent all the cultures of which your child has a heritage. For us, that's Japanese, Danish, Swedish, Irish, English. And so we have quite a bit going on with Japanese boxes of costumes. We have a lot of Japanese food in our home constantly. We go to Japanese festivals and concerts. We also do some things that are more Danish and Swedish oriented because we don't want to overlook that culture. We have a lot of storybooks in our house that I started with my children from a very young age before racial awareness dawns, which doesn't really come in until 5, 6, or 7. But at 2 or 3, they would sit on my lap and I'd flip through the storybook and read it to them and say, wow, there's a little girl with blonde hair and eyes that look like daddy's. Gosh, she looks a lot like you. Isn't she beautiful? To normalize the fact of being multiracial. And that's the first most important thing we can do. As we do that, we're also giving them the message that this is an open conversation. And that is the most important thing that we can do for our kids, is to say this is an open conversation. Things will come up, things will arise, and they do, as my 8-year-old could tell you. And it is always something we can discuss. The worst thing, and what seemed to put most kids in that more at-risk category, was the concept that it couldn't be discussed at home. Because if someone's telling you you're black, but you know that mom is white, you can't discuss that with your parents. And that means that you unconsciously begin to think that there must be something wrong with you if it can't be discussed. And it puts the onus on the child to figure out what it means to be multiracial. And it puts the onus on the child that they have to work that confusion through, when really that confusion is society's confusion. So the number one thing that I want parents to know and avoid is having a mum approach.
Hmm. we can't ignore it. You can't pretend that the differences aren't there.
You need to just make it part of the conversation the same way you might if your child had diabetes or if they were gifted in some wonderful area and needed to know that, okay, the fact that they can multiply, you know, at the age of four is wonderful and neat. It's a matter of celebrating their background in the same moment that you're making it that open dialogue.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion of raising multiracial children.
Two excellent books written by hosts Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, are available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with author Donna Jackson Nakazawa, who wrote Does Anybody Else Look Like Me? About the issues involved in raising multiracial children.
I know a family where the mother, there's some mixed racial children, multiracial children in the family. The mother consciously sought a dentist for the children.
That's right.
Who was not just your run-of-the-mill, looks-like-everybody-else dentist, and a babysitter in the same kind of category. And those were just routine people these children deal with all the time.
Well, that is another point, and that's a wonderful point. Our pediatrician is half Japanese, half Caucasian. I would have picked her anyway because she's the best pediatrician in the world, but she also happens to be a fabulous role model. The more that you can have those role models in your child's life, particularly if you live in an area that's non-diverse, to work in those role models, also to form play groups which involve other children of mixed race, so that your child always has a point of reference to come back to. If they go out in the world and somebody on the playground says, well, are you black or are you white? What are you? You have to choose, because kids are really into compartmentalizing. And it happens all the time, especially as they approach adolescence. Your child has a frame of reference to come back to. Well, I play with Grant and Ken and Sam all the time, and we're all mixed race. It's normal. Which brings me to another critical point, and that is that as we have this dialogue with our kids, we really want to convey to them and help them make the leap that from thinking there might be something wrong with being different and leap to the idea that maybe there's something wrong with people thinking that they're different. So to externalize that feeling, so that if someone says to them, well, why that's not your mom. What do you mean? Why did that white woman come to pick you up? That can't be your mother. Instead of thinking there's something wrong with my family, we're freaks, we're weirdos, they think, well, what is wrong with that person for asking that question? So a dialogue that I often have with my kids goes like this. Just recently, we were in an ice cream shop, and somebody made a comment. And we came home, and I said to my 8.5-year-old, whose eyes were wide open, wow, what a shame that 12-year-old boy hasn't had the experiences we've had. He doesn't seem to know that families come in all different combinations of skin color and cultures the way that we know they do. We have all these friends. Think of your friend so-and-so and your friend so-and-so and your friend so-and-so. And we know that families come from all different kinds of backgrounds, and we have friends all over the world like that. And in Japan, we had lots of families like that. Gosh, it's a shame that he hasn't had that experience and doesn't have a broader worldview. What am I doing? I'm taking it out of what's wrong with us as a family, and I'm saying unconsciously to his little mind, what's wrong with a society that doesn't get it?
Does this mean that these kids are going to be constantly swimming upstream, or do you see a change?
Well, that brings me back to that sort of dividing line that I saw, where there were these super confident, thriving kids who seemed to have something extra. And I have a group of young teen and young 20s, multiracial kids all over the country who are so near and dear to my heart now, because I have seen what they've been through. And I've heard their experiences and what they endured when they walked into the cafeteria at 15 and they had to choose which table to sit at. Mm. Or when they were on the all-white lacrosse team and had to listen to the boys in the locker room knock the Asian kids on the chess team. I have seen what they've been through, and sometimes it's very difficult. They report things like never being able to be all of themselves at the same time, or having to prove that they were black enough to hang out with the black kids, or having to prove that they were, you know, white enough to hang out with the white kids, or friends' parents picking them up for carpool and saying, "What do you mean you're Italian? You're not Italian," and so on and so forth. And the combination, again, of these experiences being very, well, I guess I could say that one young man told me a story that was so moving that he, for a while, between the ages of 14 and 15, believed he was an alien. He was an alien. Because the combination of these effects and people on the street asking him, "What are you?" and people at school saying, "Well, you know, you have to choose. You can either hang out with them or you can hang out with us," made him experience this otherness. And then filling out school forms, which said check one race, and he wanted to check Korean and Caucasian and couldn't, he truly believed that he was alien. So when I look at those experiences, and then I see that this is someone who 5 years later has started the largest national foundation for multiracial youth, is getting huge amounts of grant money from major corporations to fund a magazine, which is going out to the largest growing segment of the population under the age of 18 in America. And his ability to walk into different groups of different races and be a link to bring these groups of people together.
Donna, before we go any further, how can people reach that organization and what's the name of it?
It's called the Maven Foundation, and they can email the Maven Foundation or go to their website at www.mavenfoundation.org.
And Maven spelled just like you would think.
M-A-V-I-N. And in Hebrew, I believe it means one who understands. I believe that's a translation.
How appropriate.
And they are a fabulous organization for teens and young adults. Fabulous publications, fabulous events. So I would really recommend that to anyone. Another young woman who I interviewed, her mom and her brother, and she was mixed Vietnamese black and adopted. So lots of stuff going on for her. And she had 5 mixed race adopted siblings.
Oh my goodness.
And 2 Caucasian adopted siblings. So this was really quite a family. They were quite amazing. She grew up having the issue of being mixed race quite normalized by living in a group of 8 people for whom this was an everyday event. Nevertheless, when she went to school, it was really an issue. And she was told she looked like a door hit her in the face. Was she black? Was she white? She wasn't accepted by the Asians. She wasn't accepted by the blacks. She wasn't accepted by the Caucasians or the Latinos. And there ensued a few very painful years for her. No one wanted to date her, which is another issue,
that
the dating issue.
And
finally, something she said rose up in her, and she said at about the age of 15 and a half, because 13 and 14 are the worst years, "I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm going to select friends who I like for who they are, and they select me for who I am, and I'm just going to make one friend at a time." And she did, and by 12th grade, other kids in her school were all coming to the same parties of every racial background, because by making one relationship after another with a child who was African American, Latino, Caucasian, Vietnamese, she managed to start something different in that school. And her brother reported to me that when we went to high school, no racial group spoke to another. And when we were leaving high school, Jana had every single kid in that school coming to the same events and being on the same teams. And that's the kind of bridging that I'm talking about. I'm not saying that it's their responsibility to do this as multiracial youth. I don't want to put that on them, because I think it's our society that we really need to work on.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion of raising multiracial children.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Donna Jackson Nakazawa, author of Does Anybody Else Look Like Me?, about the issues involved in raising multiracial children.
Is this an American story? Do you have this kind of thing happening in France, in Germany, in Turkey?
It's such a wonderful question because I think it goes to the core of America itself. When we look at America and the history of the founding of this country, we can see that people came from all cultures, from all countries, and they still are. And it is a uniquely American tale that you can come to this country, as my husband's family did from Asia, and you can have three children, and one of them can be walking down the street one day and see a girl with a dog. That would be me. And but as we go through our unique American society, we meet people. We are interested in people. We talk to people. We sit next to them at the lunch table. We are chatting with them at the water cooler. And we begin to become interested. We go out on dates. We fall in love. We get married. We have children. It is a uniquely American story. And you can see it in the numbers that are unbelievable. We know that interracial marriages rose from 1.5 million in 1990 to only a decade later to over 4 million. So this is a huge number. When you think of those marriages, you must think of those children. We know that there are about 4.5 million multiracial children under the age of 18 in America today. But that's actually not the whole story. Two factors emerge from that number. One is that while about 25% of the U.S. population is under 18, 42% of the multiracial population is under the age of 18. Mm-hmm.
Demographers
look to that under 18 group to see how is America growing, how is it changing. Move out to California or anywhere on the West Coast, and you'll see that birth rates today, between 1 in 6 and 1 in 7 new babies being born, are multiracial. And this holds true in a lot of metropolitan cities. So as that number increases, we see that we really are the melting pot.
Donna, one of the questions that I would imagine you came up against with the people you interviewed was, what happens with dating when you bring home somebody who doesn't look like your own family?
I can say that some of the most interesting stories emerged around that question. I was told one story by a family that a girl who had been best friends with a boy who was Caucasian, and she was of mixed Asian background, they had been best friends for years, and one day when they were 13, the mom of the Caucasian boy called and said, I just want to have this conversation before it becomes an issue. I love the fact that they're best friends, but I would not be comfortable with their dating. That's only one of dozens of stories. Girls report their boyfriends saying to them, wow, gee, you know, I'd love to bring you home, but my mom told me she doesn't want little brown grandbabies. And on and on and on. And it sort of comes together at this crucial point, which is probably the major pressure point in multiracial children's lives. And that is that 13 to 15 span, where kids so badly want to be like everyone else. And other children are trying to merge with groups that are just like them. They're trying on different identities. They're all wearing the same basketball shoes and piercing their belly buttons together. And suddenly, you don't fit. And it can be an excruciating time. And dating really brings home that fact for a lot of multiracial children.
Before we close, what kinds of resources would you recommend for parents or adults who are working with multiracial children?
Well, in addition to the Maven Foundation, which is more for teens and young adults, I highly suggest people get in touch with the Association of Multi-Ethnic Americans, otherwise known as AMIA, and they can be reached at www.amiasite.org.
Can you spell that?
Yes, A-M-E-A. SITE.org. Another wonderful foundation comes out of Berkeley, California. It's called the HAPA Issues Forum. And again, I'll spell it www.HAPAISSUESFORUM.org. And HAPA in Hawaiian means one who is of Asian descent and Caucasian descent. And that term has become a little more broadly used to refer to people of mixed race background.
In the back of this wonderful book, Does Anybody Else Look Like Me?, is a list of recommended reading for children in multiracial families. There are readings for adults. There are readings for adopted children or families with adopted children. All kinds of wonderful suggestions.
We are so grateful to have had the voice of experience of Donna Jackson Nakazawa to discuss the complex issues involved in raising multiracial children. Thanks for being with us today, Donna.
Thank you so much for asking me. It's been a pleasure.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Donna Jackson Nakazawa's book, Does Anybody Else Look Like Me? Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show 192. Tell us if you can what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Our books, Parents as Mentors in Washington, D.C. with Kids, are both available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our books Parents as Mentors and Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, http://i.am/parentsperspective. That's http://i.am/parentsperspective. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.